come here today to talk about philosophy and literature. You may know Warwick has a long history of, in 16 of things, maybe it's a short history, but since the university began, pretty much, there's been an ongoing engagement with philosophy and literature in their interrelations, and we think one of the best ways to pursue that is to hear the new research that's being done in the field, and so that's why I'm eager to gather new scholars here at Warwick. We have a quite diverse program today. I hope the conversation gels somehow, and it will be up to you to make that happen in various ways. I have a couple of business things to say. One is we would like to take photographs occasionally during the sessions so we can have some visual evidence of the event. So if you have objections to that, will you please let Daniel know? Second, let me introduce, if you haven't met already, Daniel McRae and Karen Simichek, and they're the graduate organizers of the event, and they can help you with any problems that arise during the day. And I think we're ready then, so I'm going to turn it over to our chair for the first session here, Karen.
Okay, so first up we have Tess Stevenson, who is So he's currently studying at Manchester University and he's looking at ontology and meta-ontology stories. And as you can see, he's taken on advancing in ontology stories.
Okay, well, I guess like at school when they put maths at the beginning, this is a bit like getting the metaphysics out of the way so we can move on to other things while you still question breakfast. But what I want to talk about is the ontology of stories, how stories exist, the nature of their existence. But first of all, quickly what I mean by stories. So introducing stories, one way to get a grasp of the concept is just, it's a distinction between the telling and the story that's told. Narratologists commonly use that kind of idea. So imagine we have a story, I might label the story, give it the name, the parable of the sower, and say that's the story, and then the little bit of text in each gospel and in each, like in all the various translations across the different languages and the paraphrases and all the different ways, they're all tellings of that same story, and somehow all those tellings tell the same story, we think. So the question is, what is that story that all these different tellings are telling, and how do they do that? Obviously, it's a very big question. I'm going to be focusing particularly on a question of identity, identity conditions for stories, and how that works, looking at a paper recently published by Aaron Smuts, who raises this question and sort of leaves it hanging, so I'm just sort of picking up where he left off. And opening up the debate a bit more. So what I'm going to do quickly is introduce stories, then Smuts says, here's two options, which pose a dilemma, because either we have the strict account, which I'll explain, and then we have the lenient account, and both of them are problematic. So what are we going to do? So that's his dilemma, and I discuss those two, and then I'm going to say, here's an alternative, which hopefully gets us out of this problem. But one way to look at what I'm doing is really providing three kind of pegs here on which to hang kind of further discussion and questions, because you might want to reject this and then go back to these two, and there's, you know, all sorts of ways you could go from it. Okay, so Smuts is questioned about story identity, so it's quite a difficult thing to ask what is a story, so maybe let's just focus on how do we identify the same story on two different tellings. So he puts the question, what exactly constitutes the story that's retold? Although it's plausible to say the same story can be retold, it's difficult to say exactly what this means. The primary difficulty for proponents of the transposability thesis, the thesis that a story can be transposed, say, from a book to a film, or from one language to another language, is to come up with an acceptable theory of story identity, of how we do that, and what's going on. Okay, so he says, here's an idea. What if the story is understood as like the, we'd say kind of a form-content distinction in every telling, and say the story is the content and the telling is the form, and maybe the content is everything that's being told to be the case by any particular telling, whether it's a film or a play or a novel or something. And so the identity conditions for this kinds of thing would be quite strict and quite tight. You know, it's and one way to go about that is to is I this isn't from Smuts, this is me sort of tightening it up a bit. We could go for this kind of identity condition. So maybe two tellings tell the same story just if the propositions that are true according to the tellings are the same. And we haven't got time to go into what exactly it might mean to say propositions true according to the telling, but you might just think of it as, so you read a novel and it makes all these claims. There's quite a lot of literature on how you might work out what is being asserted by the novel or what is being said to be the case in the world of the story. And there's lots of different kind of glosses you could give on that. But at the moment, I'm going to just sort of go with an intuitive notion of what it might mean. Maybe we can talk about it more in the questions. But then this raises a problem that it seems that if you go with this really strict account, we just don't really ever tell the same story. And to see why, suppose that I want to retell the story of the parable of the sower using a comic strip. I just want to draw, you know, a few boxes with characters in. You know, it's a short story; it shouldn't take me long. And I colour in one of the characters, the sower's the guy doing the sowing. I colour in his hair brown. Then on most accounts of what is true according to my telling, he's got brown hair. There's a guy sowing and he's got brown hair. But it's not part of the original story. So then I'm asserting something which isn't part of the original telling. So according to this very strict account, I'm telling a different story because I've got more details. And you see that that's a kind of account can be given all over the place, especially for if you think of a play script being performed, the play script will leave a lot of details, you know, to the production to fill in, such as what the characters look like, what they sound like, what colour hair they've got, all these things that that are plausibly being kind of made told to be the case. You know, when someone walks on and they're playing the character Hamlet and they look a certain way, according to that production, it seems that Hamlet looks that way and speaks that way and is that much taller than this character. And you know, maybe we can debate that afterwards. But as a starting position, that might be kind of a result of this strict account. So it seems that even when we've got a play script and the play being performed, even then we're not getting the same story. But surely if any time we have the same story, it's then. So that seems to be a problem for this. So moving on quickly, Smuts then says, well, maybe we need to loosen things up a bit. So he turns to sort of maybe stories are higher level entities. And really what he's just getting at here, I think, is that maybe we can just be a bit more relaxed about what we take to be the kind of the core elements of the story that's being told. So we might come up with a more lenient account that just says, oh yeah, two tellings, they tell the same story, just if there's this kind of core set of things being claimed to be the case. So we can exclude all the stuff like about hair colour of the characters, because that's just not part of the story really. What we need is this kind of core set of things that matter in any kind of retelling of the same story. And as long as those are included in the retelling, then you've successfully told the same story. So two tellings tell the same story, just if there's a core set of propositions essential to the story that are made true by each telling. Way to formalise it. Now, Smuts raises a couple of problems for this. The first one I want to reject quite quickly. Firstly, he says that if we have this account, then we lose the separation between the telling and the story told, he thinks. So he says this is because what is essential to a story and the kind of the core elements are going to depend a great deal on the how it's told, on the kind of production. So, for example, in The Godfather, Michael Corleone, his first killing that he does is kind of filmed very slowly, and as time seems to slow down, the way it's filmed kind of really makes that a significant feature of the film. And you might think, well, that's a very important element of that story told because of the way it's filmed. And then Smuts says, well, this doesn't seem right, because surely the story should be independent and shouldn't depend on the way it's told. I just wanted to reject that as being perhaps a misunderstanding of the distinction between the story and the telling, because it seems that it's absolutely fine that the way you tell something will depend on what you're telling. So what you put emphasis on and where you put the emphasis will significantly influence the kind of story you're telling. So that doesn't seem to be a problem. And what is perhaps more of a problem is that if we go with this, we seem to lose a grip on the distinction, and plausibly we really want a distinction here, between genuinely telling the same story on two different occasions and just telling stories of the same kind or type. Because if you wanted to give an account of what it is to tell stories of the same kind, say the Cinderella kind, you know, there's lots of Cinderella kinds of stories, Disney's Cinderella and the film Made in Manhattan, they're just kind of Cinderella kinds. It's going to be something very similar to this, except maybe the set of core propositions is smaller or something. So any real distinction between genuinely telling the same story and just telling stories of the same kind seems to dissolve or at least become just a matter of degree. And another kind of intuition is that we don't want that. We want, ontologically, we want some real distinction between genuine identity and just identity of kind. So that's his dilemma. Now, what I want to suggest is part of this problem, part of the problem comes from the fact that both of these accounts assume stories are what I want to call generic entities. So they're the kinds of things that that have their identity conditions given by these kinds of conditions. So a generic entity account is kind of a common approach in sort of ontology when someone says, what is a word, or what is a work of music, you know, all these kinds of things that are seem to be repeatable and they're not kind of physically locatable, you can't touch them. And one way to go is to suggest, well, they're a kind or a type, they're a generic entity, and that's just something that requires certain things of its instances in order that they be instances of that kind. So you might think of a pattern, a certain pattern. To be an instance of that pattern, it's just got to look that way, it's just got to have those shapes in it or something. So this is maybe like a pattern account of stories. Stories as patterns that tellings must match up to in order to be tellings of that story. And what I want to suggest is, so that's the generic entity approach, is that what actually, if stories are more like paintings than patterns, or and the way I want to put it is, what if stories are more like historically embedded individuals? So rather than seeing the story as this kind of pattern that things must match in order to be telling that story, what if we start viewing stories as things more like kind of our ordinary, everyday kind of historical individuals, things located in time and space, except we add to that that they're going to be abstract. And by abstract, I just mean that they're not... It's a category mistake to try and locate them somewhere. So to ask where a story is would just be a category mistake, just like asking how much January the 2nd weighs, you know, just kind of a nonsensical question. So that's all I mean by abstract. So chairs, tables, paintings, pets, people, they're all these kind of historical individuals. The suggestion is that stories are more like these, and they, to be like these, they're not these kind of generic entities, but they're things that come into existence, they can change through time, they can go out of existence. Plausibly they come into existence just on their first telling. The story of Romeo and Juliet, as that very story, didn't exist plausibly before Shakespeare came along and wrote down that play. Similarly, maybe stories change through time. This is kind of easier to see if we think firstly of kind of oral epics or ballads that kind of change as they kind of go through the history. Retellings add elements or lose elements. But you can also see it in more modern accounts. If someone's putting on a series, you know, The West Wing or 24 or something like that, they're constantly writing new bits of the story. Those ones, you know, those series on television where, like, drama series or The Archers or, you know, something where it's like one continual very big story, they're constantly adding to it. So whatever the story is, it seems to be getting bigger, which is a good way of changing. So stories seem to be changing there. And maybe stories also go out of existence. You know, when a culture is lost, or we might also say that we've lost the stories that their folk stories have also gone, because there's no way of getting them back, there's no memories of them, there's no inscriptions of them. Okay, so if these are correct claims to make about stories, that they are coming to existence, that they change, and they can go out of existence, then it's a mistake perhaps to try and understand them in terms of just a set of conditions that something must meet, And so perhaps we don't need to accept strict or lenient, those two accounts that I suggested, any more than we should accept that that we have the same chair on two different days if and only if it looks a certain way. Because presumably the same chair can be red and upright one day and blue and broken the next. And so with kind of ordinary historical objects, we have much more complex identity conditions and understandings of how they kind of continue to be the same thing through time, even through all these changes. So instead, perhaps, and here I can only sketch out the beginnings of a suggestion, perhaps retelling a story is more like a matter of being kind of causally connected in the right kind of way to previous tellings of that story. Maybe it's a matter of having the right kind of intentions. Maybe it's a matter even of the audience interpreting it as that story. And, you know, clearly judgments about the specific elements will be involved in recognising it, but that doesn't mean that having those elements makes it that story, just as I can recognise a person by how they look, but they're not that person just because they look that way, you know, as they grow older they'll change. So this view of stories as historical individuals rather than generic entities, it still raises a lot of questions, perhaps just as many as it might answer, but it does help explain, I think, some apparent confusion between genuinely telling the same story and telling stories of the same kind. So we could say that a story type or a kind, the Cinderella kind or the boy meets girl kind of story, is a genuine type. You know, something can be a boy meets girl story just if it has these elements in it. You know, that's the end. But the confusion arises because our language is ambiguous. Sometimes you want to say that two stories are the same historical individual, and other times you want to say that two stories are merely of the same story type. So consider my claim, that I was wearing that watch yesterday, I might say. Now there's ambiguity here between whether I mean I was wearing that same kind of watch or whether you've stolen my watch type thing. I want to suggest maybe as it is with watches, so it is with stories. So the Worcester Group's production of Hamlet and Laurence Olivier's production tell the same story as genuine historical individuals, but the film Made in Manhattan and Disney's Cinderella just tell the same kind of story in virtue of having certain kind of core elements in them. Now, as I said, clearly there's much more that needs to be said to flesh out an account of stories as have abstract historical individuals, and there's a difficult question about how we understand what it is to actually make that claim, to say, oh, they're just historical individuals like tables and chairs, but abstract. You know, is that really a substantial thing to say, and does it just kind of leave us a bit puzzled as to what kinds of things they are, kind of ontologically speaking? But I'm suggesting if we can let go of the assumption that stories are generic entities, then maybe we can sort of avoid Smuts's dilemma about the two kind of strict and lenient accounts that he proposes. And I'll leave it.
I'm going to comment. I guess that maybe.
Should I sit down?
I'm just going to turn the projector off for a moment. We can turn it back on. Okay. Jeff Stevenson asks us here to think about how stories fit into the furniture of the universe. What kind of thing is a story? The focus here, story, is a nice, difficult one, as story is a notion that cuts across some standard categories. Stories can be fiction or nonfiction, artistic or not, and in general, they display our urges both to document what happens and to judge what is worth perceiving. Stevenson's essay has made me think that story is also difficult to pin down in ontological terms. Let me admit that I have a confusing response to his argument. Roughly, I'll suggest that he may be right about what stories are, but that we then seem to resist treating them like what they are. Stevenson, responding to a discussion by Aaron Smuts, and I'm really impressed you've already responded, the paper came out like a month ago or something, or two, maybe a couple months ago. Stevenson rejects the idea that a story is a generic kind, something that specifies a set of conditions which must be realized in instances of that kind. If we did take stories to be generic kinds, we would end up stuck with being either impossibly rigid about story content or unhelpfully relaxed. Stevenson argues that we should instead take stories to be historical individuals, like this piece of paper, or Queen Victoria, or Duchamp's fountain. Having the status of a historical individual allows a story to have a substantial identity, which is fixed by tellings that occur at particular times with particular content, and by the causal and intentional relations of later tellings to earlier ones. Yet, this way of identifying a story is not overly rigid about what particular content a telling of the same story must have, as stories on this view can change over time, and indeed they come into and can go out of existence. Story identity is fixed by the connected historical path taken by a series of tellings, rather than being fixed by elements of essential story content. Now, why does this seem like a plausible account of what stories are? This is partly due to the appeal of linking the existence of things to the evidence we have for their existence. What we encounter are the tellings of stories, and the historical individual account anchors the existence of a story in the occurrence of a set of tellings of that story. Further, it sounds plausible that stories are sustained by collaborative intentions and recognition of intentions and by causally linked practices. For something to be a story, it seems it has to make sense in some kind of shared practice. All of this roots the existence of stories in good, solid facts about what people do and the impact we have on each other. On these grounds, I would say that the historical individual account gives stories a satisfying way of existing temporally in full coordination with our storytelling activities. Why then might one say that, nonetheless, we don't treat stories as historical individuals? Let me approach this by raising a question about what happens to the distinction between a story and its tellings on the historical individual's account. Stevenson begins his essay with the example of the many tellings of the parable of the sower to show that we commonly do distinguish between a story and the telling of that story, and that we want to be able to say that the same story can be told in different ways. But what is the relationship between a story and its tellings if a story exists via its tellings? One might argue that the story is its set of tellings on this account. Maybe one could say that where there is more than one telling involved, the story comprised by all of them is different from each individual telling, so there would be a distinction between a story and any given telling. But it wouldn't seem to be a distinction that could support interesting critical discourse about stories and their different tellings. The story emerges from the historical path taken by the various tellings, and each of those tellings, as long as it was causally and intentionally related in the right way to earlier tellings, would be a perfectly exemplary manifestation of the story. The story itself, despite having a longer history and more complexity than any particular telling of it, wouldn't seem to have any regulatory or determinative status in relation to its tellings. Meanwhile, we seem to think that stories can be badly told and well told, as if some tellings don't fully manifest the nature of the story. We act as if a story has some reality independent of its tellings that could, for instance, determine that a given telling, even if it stood in proper causal and intentional relations to earlier tellings, was not a telling of that story. In general, it seems we want to have a notion of story that allows the story to be a specification of content that no teller of a story has complete control over. Even the originator of a story could tell it badly, meaning not just that the parts that should have been funny were boring, etc., but that critical junctures of action and motivation were obscured. The role that story has in this sense is to be a specification of content that the tellings have to reckon with and do justice to. The teller, like the listener, is an interpreter of what is there to be told. When we say that Shakespeare did a great job with the Romeo and Juliet story, it seems we are trying to register his achievement in relation to a story that is in some sense not of his making, even if he were the first to tell that story. It is in this sense that it seems to me we resist treating stories as historical individuals. Are we misguided? Or is this reason not to accept the historical individual's account? I'll stop at this point and thank Jeff for plunging me into quite stimulating uncertainty.
Yeah, so following up on Eileen's comment, I really like the idea of history as the historical individual of the third way, and it seems to me that intuitively that seems the right way, part of the right way to go, that that has to be into any satisfying account somewhere. The question I have for you is, it does seem to me that you have to answer, okay, so the story changes like a historical individual. I'm not sure by the way that paintings are what you want to make a comparison with, because paintings don't change, they only kind of degenerate. I mean, and then they get restored. But that's a side issue. So stories change like a historical individual. But my question is, what is it that changes? If you then ask, what is it that changes, isn't it the case that all those original questions that you started off with from Smuts come rolling back in? You know, is it the words that change? Is it the pattern that changes? Is it the set of propositions true according to the story that changes? And unless you if you're going to have to decide an answer to that, then you're going to have to answer Eileen's question, which is, you know, so you want some combination of this historical individual causally related in the right way, but the right way is going to involve some sense of what a story is beyond merely this changing historical, this individual subject to the vicissitudes of history.
Yeah, I mean, first I'll pick up on the point about paintings. I mean, you're probably right there. I mean, the only kind of reason to sort of pick up on that is that we do take them to be similarly works of art, so if stories are works of art, then that's that kind of similarity. But also, we can accept that they can be damaged, and damage, if that's just change, if, you know, someone slashes it with a knife, the painting itself has changed. The way that we don't regard paintings is just being the picture that they show. You know, if you take a photo of a painting, you're not reproducing the painting. So that's just the intuition. Yeah, I think the question about what it is that changes is very important. Maybe if we, but I wonder if you can allow any sort of answer to that question. Perhaps you say it's the emphasis changes, maybe the meaning of elements changes, obviously interpretations are going to change. But as long as there's change allowed somewhere, and we don't tie its identity to the elements that are changing, but to something else. Now I understand this is sort of still kind of quite hand-wavy, because it's like, what is it? You want to sort of get a grasp on what it is that is actually changing. But if we allow it to be sort of to evolve in whatever way we might like, then we can, I guess the idea is that we can begin to think about it in the ways that we think about the identity of other kinds of kind of historical individuals. Not that they're easy questions to answer, you know, the classical philosophical questions about the identity of the ship of Theseus over time, and if you replace all the planks, what happens, you know, and build another ship with the ones you replace, which one's the actual ship of Theseus? And, you know, these are very difficult questions, but so the suggestion is that we maybe think about stories along those lines rather than along the pattern line. I don't know if that...
Right. I mean, except that if you allow any kind of answer to what it is that changes, I wonder what you're going to be left with when you try to fill in your prospective blank about causally committed in the right way. You know, and figuring out what the right way will be if you can't refer to patterns
of
So you might want to instead try to combine your historical criterion with the most suitable. You know, maybe it mustn't change so that the plot or the pattern becomes unrecognizable, and then try and figure out what the conditions of unrecognizability might be, and so on.
Yeah.
But I think it's very fruitful to put in historical change.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that relates to this question, to this comment. I'm not so sure about the distinction you made between generic kind of story. A story is a historical entity, it's a historical individual. Because the kind of story, why would that not be a historical entity? Because you determine historical element. Not only is that which changes, but also is that which passes from telling to another telling, and so on and so forth. So story as a type, as a kind as well, could be thought as being that element which passes from a telling to a retelling.
Mm-hmm.
It is a teaching story identity itself. So in that case, that means you have to presuppose a very peculiar idea of historical element, or something that is historical, something which only changes. So you may change as the dominant characteristic of the historical element. But it's not just, it's also the fact that it passes through time, it goes from a telling to a retelling, and so on and so forth. So if that's the case, if you accept that characteristic has been dominant, has been fundamental with respect to what a story is, then story as a type can be also seen as a historical element.
Am I understanding you right? There is a suggestion that that type theories or generic entity theories can incorporate historical elements, and it's one I'm quite sympathetic to actually. So that it's that kind of story, just because it does satisfy these conditions, but they're historical conditions rather than structural conditions, or maybe they're a mix of the two. So we still have this kind of generic entity approach, but it's a historical generic entity, and that to be a telling of that story, or to be a playing of that work of music, it doesn't just have to sound a certain way, it also has to be connected to some composer or to some author or something. So you might, maybe that's a, is that?
Yeah, so this way you'll be able to combine the story as a type or as a pattern, and story as a historical individual, because you won't abandon history. You'll abandon the feature of history in your determination of the story.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. Something since I've kind of worked on this, I've kind of moved more towards that that question. It's a sort of a desire to let go of a really strict structural theory of what the story is, and sort of embrace a possibility that it's a type that just requires, as I said, these kind of historical connections or causal origins, or, you know, had to come from this author and have been copied in this kind of way. But yeah, I think that's probably a good way to go, to try and sort of bring together some of the elements.
I'm very interested by your presentation. I'm trying to work out some of the implications. I think it may be an implication of yours that you may not know whether you're dealing with one story or two, which is right. You started with a reference to the New Testament, let's take the New Testament, in the Synoptic Gospels, including the earliest one, Mark, we have what are presented as two stories when a whole multitude were hungry and Jesus feeds 5,000 and there's food left over at the end and they pick up a certain amount. And then later 4,000 and they pick up at the end a different amount. Often thought that all those early gospel writers may have been drawing from either written or oral sources to go back much earlier. So we don't actually know what the first, if that's right, and we don't know whether it's right or not, are telling whether we're dealing initially with two versions of the same possibly historical event. And again, this raises the whole issue about the story in the context of what it presented as something relating to a historical event, and ones like your parables, which are not. So on your generic account, on the generic account you give, depends what counts as the core, is the difference between 4 and 5 and the number of baskets picked up, those propositional elements. Are they part of the core, or could they be taken as variables? So that's clearly one of the variations. Is it that when in the first record of which we know, they are presented as two different events and stories of two different events, does that make them two different stories? But if in fact they are variations of what originally was a single story, and we don't have the detail of one particular event, many people Is it the case that we may not know whether we're dealing with the same story or not? And if so, does it matter? I suppose that's the question underlying this interesting exegesis of the New Testament. What is the significance of whether we're the same story or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. I'm not sure I know the answers, for sure. I mean, you might think that in the case of stories that are supposed to be linked to actual events, news reports or historical accounts, that you might want to quite strictly individuate them by the events that they're supposed to be accounts of. I think we can accept that there's going to be lots of difficult questions about on any account of what a story is, about when we're telling the same story and whether or not these two stories are going to be the same, just as you'll have different genuine disagreements over whether or not the new film that's come out of that book is telling the same story, or whether or not they've given up too much of what's important, and they're do you then go and ask, you know, the director, were you trying to tell this story, or were you trying to tell your own story based on it? And, you know, right. It all becomes quite fuzzy and subjective. Yeah. And that's kind of an ongoing problem for any account. What's interesting is that it's also an ongoing problem for any account of identity of anything. We can appeal to sort of natural kinds if we think, oh, we can have a much firmer grip on the identity of those kinds of natural objects, like biological things, like people and animals and stuff in biology suggests that even that's a bit tricky. I'm not sure about the. I really like the example of the feeding of the 5 and 4,000, whether or not they would.
Well, something to throw into your thinking about this.
There are
implications of what you're saying that are actually quite teasing.
Yeah, and it might turn out that they're. For some people it's the same story, and for some people it's a different story, and whether or not it's the same depends on what it is that they're interested in the first place, and so what it is that they're actually picking out with their practice and their language and their assessment is determined by that practice and that language. And so two groups of people might look at the same text and actually pick out a different thing in each case, and then you end up with a sort of a conflict, just as you might imagine. You have a kind of classic problem of someone's mind being transported into another body, and you say, well, is it now that person who's got the mind in that body? Well, if you're kind of very much like the person is their physical stuff, and that's the approach you're taking, you might come up with one answer. But if you're more interested in the kind of the memories, you might come up with another answer. If you're focusing on the soul or something, you might come up with a third answer. And there might be a way of working all these into sort of still having objective accounts of what it is to be identical across two different
cases. Maybe it's worth pointing out, this is clearly the way that often these things are done, not only in terms of people preaching on the New Testament, certainly where what you say is right, but in it might be worth thinking about the Jewish tradition of Midrash, where with respect to the Old Testament stories, where the way of interpreting a story is often by telling another one, which is then illuminates the first one. But then which one you're illuminating may well depend upon your interest in telling the second story, and hence what is to count as the same story on which to which this story is commented will depend upon your particular aim. And so the Talmuds and the Midrash more generally are full of this sort of thing, and you have a constant shifting in what counts as the initial story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Certainly if you look in the Torah, you find what looked like the same story told quite differently, but there are different periods in the so-called wilderness wanderings, so how are you to put them together? So it's an old problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question.
I wanted to pick up on part of your response to the question, and also ask more generally about the nature of the historical embedding, and ask about a particular medium in which stories are communicated, I guess, which is it, text and print. And a lot of her examples came from
ways in which people were looking at a text, but then coming up with a telling of the story. And then that's what you picked up, is that two people from different contexts could look at the same text, but then could tell it differently. And so I was wondering about, because obviously your paper was dealing with both tellings, but also with stories themselves. And so I was wondering a bit about the distinction there, what whether different tellings have to occur in order for a story to change, or whether stories can change without any indication that there's an act of telling going on. Then sort of things like novels or journalism even, I guess, or any sort of text like that, I don't know if just reading something would be similar to an act of telling or an act of staging a play or something like that. But I was thinking about cases where books are read at a certain point and then go out of print or something like that, and then seem to gain some sort of significance in a new time period sort of, or republished. And whether that's the same, whether there's a difference in story there, because obviously, unlike a painting, you take a book out of print and that doesn't destroy the, you wouldn't want to say that destroys the story that the book is telling. So I'm sorry, that's a sort of disjointed sort of question. I don't know where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, you might just pick up on the point of I was focusing on tellings that obviously change, so they, if they're different kind of texts, they're different texts in each case. There's an interesting question about whether or not the same text, accurately copied over a certain amount of time can result in a change of story. And I guess it would depend on your understanding of how the meanings of the words might change over time. Whether or not there is such a thing as the text. I mean, so you've got this kind of set of inscriptions on your, in front of you, and even in the process of reading that, you've got to sort of interpret them, that's a P, that's an A, that kind of thing, or whether or not that kind of maybe casts some doubt on whether or not there is this kind of the text that, I mean, the whole other question, but it's a very interesting one about. And maybe the story that's told can change just in virtue of different cultures or different time, people at different times, understanding the meanings of different things differently.
And that seems like embedding in a different way from sort of embedding in a particular performance or decision style.
Yeah, I think I'd probably want to have both of them in the account, because they both seem to be important.
Can I throw one example in? Because I was trying to think about stories going out of existence and what that might be like. And it relates to your kind of example. I recently saw part of a movie from the 1930s called Theodora Goes Wild. Anyone know this movie? So anyway, it's a very problematic movie to watch now. And here's a scene that was an important element of the story in the 1930s, where you have Theodora visiting the apartment of a man unaccompanied. Okay, so Theodora is in an apartment with a man. And that was an important part of the story in that, as the movie is presented, because she shouldn't be there, so possibly scandalous. And it's just not an element of a story anymore. It's like, okay, there's a woman in an apartment with a man. I can't, it's not a story in a sense. It's like, no longer a story. And so the movie, in a way, I think it doesn't work. It doesn't tell a story in quite the same way. So it hasn't been lost. It's just that you can't process it and think, I see what that's doing there. You kind of know what it's doing there, but it doesn't actually function the right way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to Jeff and Ian.